McCoy Tyner on piano, along with Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Ron Carter on bass, and Elvin Jones on drums, with a number called Contemplation. Recorded in 1967, Tyner's music began to reflect a deep search within himself for the meaning of life. He's still going strong at age 80. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today we're going nuclear. Making good on an election year promise to the coal mining and nuclear energy industries and a smackdown for environmentalists, President Donald Trump last week ordered Energy Secretary Rick Perry to take what he called immediate steps, unquote, to ensure continued operations of coal mines and nuclear power plants across the country. This means that the administration is committed to continuing massive and even fatal assaults on the environment and on the people working in and living near such projects. Investigative journalist Paul DiRienzo has filed, as you recall, several reports here on Lead Stories about the sketchy state of the nation's nuclear power plants, the government's gross mismanagement of nuclear waste, and the health and environmental problems they cause populations nearby. He is joined today by Tom Carpenter, Executive Director of Hanford Challenge, a group seeking the proper disposal of nuclear waste, if there is such a thing, at the decommissioned Hanford site in Washington State and at all other such plants. They're here to explain to all of us, myself included, why the Department of Energy's new rules on nuclear waste will create environmental and health hazards that may last forever. And Paul, it's a pleasure always to have you us. And you've done so much work on this particular topic, and you've been so enlightening to us on the subject. I learned a heck of a lot from you on your reports, especially as it pertains to the Hanford site. And Tom Carpenter, you were on with us some time ago. We didn't have that much time to talk, but today hopefully we can delve a little bit deeper into this issue. Well, let's start with you, Paul. What is this Hanford site? Why is so much fuss being made about it?
Well, Tom can give you more details, but I like to put it, I look at my wall here, and I got myself a schoolhouse a map of the United States, and I took little pieces of sticky note labels, and I put every place that I could find in the literature that had something to do with the Manhattan Project and later on the Cold War. And literally, I covered my whole map with these little stickers, you know, and a lot of them have fallen off. And over the year, I've had it on, and there's still so many up there. And I look, and I see West Valley, New York, Knowles Power Laboratory, Lake Ontario, and New York Work, Manhattan Project in Manhattan, and Brookhaven Labs, places I forgot what the NFS, UDS, Fernald, Portsmouth, Mound, Y-12, Savannah, Paducah, Argonne. My gosh, it covered. I think there was a science. One of the Manhattan Project scientists said, in the early days, they'll never build an atom bomb because they'd have to turn the whole United States into a giant atom bomb factory to do it. And afterwards, he said, I guess they did. And, you know, there's a lot of waste that came from all of these places, especially in the early days when it was the wartime. You know, under wartime, that was the excuse for everything. So they just dumped it in the river. And I guess Hanford was of interest to me. Because back by the late 1950s, my dad was an engineer, and he did some work over there with one of the companies, and he told me stories that were chilling. It was like every day to him, and it was chilling to me. So I started looking into it more and more, and came into contact with Tom, who's with us now, and he works with Hanford Challenge, which does a lot of things. Among them, helps protect and the whistleblowers who come forward from these large projects and operations. And are often the only real source we have of what's going on at them. You know, there's a culture of secrecy. Even when the information was not classified, there's such a natural desire from the 50s on, especially 40s, 50s on, to just never talk about it and keep it a secret and to look down on people who did. So, the idea of telling people what was happening became sort of a great act of bravery. So you have to give a lot of kudos to the folks who've had the guts to step forward and say, well, there's terrible things going on here. Now, Tom sent me, and he'll talk about it more, a fact sheet, I guess they just released today or recently, that about the latest developments, and it's ongoing toxic soap opera of what's going on. So maybe we'll just bring that in. Tom Carpenter, are you with us?
I sure am. Hey, thanks for having me on.
No, great. Hello, Tom. No, this is such an important thing because we're talking about the Hanford nuclear site in southeastern Washington State. And it's the, as you say in your release, the most radioactively contaminated facility in the nation, with 177 underground waste tanks containing high-level radioactive waste. And they seem to run out of things to do with all this stuff. And it's my understanding that the 57 or 53 million gallons is just a drop in the bucket of all the waste that was actually produced there, and you wonder in the back of your head, whatever happened to the other 90%? Anyway, tell us what's going on at Hanford today, Tom, and what do we have to worry about?
Well, okay, so the scale of it, you just started to touch on it. Hanford stores two-thirds of the country's high-level nuclear waste and most of its low-activity nuclear waste. And this is a site, by the way, in southeastern Washington State. It's, you know, very close to the border of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And Utah is not that far away either. So, the amount of waste, the high-level waste is a technical term created, you know, by Congress. And it's based on, you know, they to make plutonium for nuclear weapons, which is what Hanford was doing. It irradiated nuclear fuel. It had uranium-235 and uranium-238, and the byproduct of this irradiation was plutonium. And plutonium did not exist naturally, except in tiny, tiny little amounts on the planet until we started doing this process. And the reason we did it was to make nuclear weapons. So as the listeners out there probably know, we made a lot of nuclear weapons, up to 65,000 nuclear weapons in this country. And Hanford created the great bulk of the plutonium used in those devices. And they did it by making plutonium basically in the reactors. They had 9 reactors, 5 reprocessing facilities, and a lot of waste. So for every, like, gram of plutonium that was created, there were tons of waste left over. So eventually, Hanford ended up making 525 million gallons of high-level waste. A lot of that got dumped to the soils deliberately. Some of it leaked out of the tanks. And there's about 56 million gallons of waste still in these old nuclear waste tanks at the Hanford site. And it is the heart of the problem at Hanford right now, that and the waste that was deliberately dumped or accidentally leaked as a result of making plutonium at Hanford. And let me just step back for a second here, because I'm using this term high-level waste. And this is stuff that is so hot that you can't get within a couple hundred yards of it. It's that radioactive. Inside these waste tanks, it would be a fatal dose of radiation in a matter of seconds in most of these tanks. The the waste lasts forever, at least in human terms. Plutonium, for instance, has this half-life of 24,000 years. It's around for 10 half-lives, so it's dangerous for a quarter of a million years. Other radionuclides have even longer half-lives, up to millions of years. And finally, this waste is biologically hazardous in microscopic quantities. It causes cancer. It causes mutations. It causes other illnesses and diseases that we're only just now beginning to understand because we're in the dawn of the nuclear age. And health effects and understanding about health effects is still a controversial subject in science. So what's happening then today is that there's been an agreement in the communities out here for at least 20 years that the waste in these tanks will be removed from the tanks and treated by mixing that waste with glass in a process called vitrification, and that this waste would then be sent to a deep geological underground repository. We don't have one of those right now, but some are being planned, and it's possible to do. And right now, there's a lot of debate about whether or not Yucca Mountain in Nevada is a suitable place. In my view, it's not, but that's another subject. But, the Trump administration came into office and said, how can we pay for these big tax cuts? How can we pay for my wall, et cetera? So, the instructions to agencies are, start cutting these budgets. And so the Department of Energy internally took a look at the price tag for dealing with Hanford's nuclear waste and said it's too high. And by the way, that price tag is in the tens of billions of dollars, ultimately reaching as high as $150 to $200 billion. The solution that some within the Department of Energy have come up with, and now is an official proposal that was issued just last week, an official proposal to not do the cleanup, in essence, is to remove some waste from the tanks, leave a bunch there, and then, dump concrete on waste that was left behind. Our concern is that they'll just keep using this internal order that has already been found to be illegal by a federal judge. But that's not stopping the Department of Energy. They're moving ahead. It will save a tremendous amount of money. No question about it. And, of course, the cleanup will go a lot quicker because instead of vitrifying this waste and putting it to a deep repository, the DOE would relabel it or rename it and say it's no longer high-level waste. It's now low-level waste. That's kind of akin to moving, the goalpost over the 50-yard line where the football is sitting and saying, hey, touchdown. Can't do it that way. This is nasty stuff.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. You please. Sorry.
I was going to ask you, in fact, Paul and Tom, it's not as if they didn't know or still don't know that the the actual conditions of the nuclear plants themselves are such that they shouldn't be thinking about storing anything at any nuclear plant. We've had, Paul, you reported about cracks. You reported about explosions that had occurred at some nuclear plants. Right. You reported about the list of medical conditions that led to death among workers at these nuclear plants. And you reported about the right. widespread contamination, nuclear contamination, not just at the plant, but in the water, in the rivers, because these plants usually are located on large rivers. On the surrounding environment. So what if that is in fact the history of these nuclear plants, what is the sense of saying, well, we should do some more storage of nuclear waste at these plants, chancing a nuclear blow up and or that the plants themselves or parts of the plants themselves would collapse. So what do you make of this decision by the president? And he seems to be doing...
Well, let me jump in, Eutrice. I just want to jump in because I want to clarify there's two different things. And I think one is... commercial nuclear plants. I want to make sure that are there's about 100 of them in the United States that produce electricity, mostly commercially. A few part of TVA are government run, but mostly they're commercial, and they produce high level waste. And that is a separate set of laws, I think, for disposing of that waste. And the one place where it all comes together is what we were discussing, Yucca Mountain, because I think that was originally, the original idea was to have that as a repository for waste from the different commercial power plants. And that has been put on hold. And right now, the waste from commercial plants are kept at the plants themselves in special casks in different sort of circumstances, but generally they're not allowed to be moved off of the property of the actual plants that are producing them. That is separate.
So, Tom, are you satisfied that the commercial plants, as opposed to the government-run plants, are in compliance or safe for storage of nuclear waste?
Well, of course not. I mean, it's many of these facilities, in fact, about a third of them, store their spent nuclear fuel in these big swimming pools, basically, where they cool these reactor rods that have been no longer used, but they're still full of radioactivity, and they're thermally very, very hot. And these a third of these are above ground, like on the fourth or fifth floor of a facility, for this purpose. They're not behind any type of secondary containment. So, you might have heard in relation to nuclear reactors, oh, they're safe. You could drive a plane into a reactor and they're designed to withstand that, blah, blah, blah. Not so true for the spent nuclear fuel pools in many of the nation's nuclear reactors where the old fuel has gone to. They are starting to dry cask some of these, but there's still a huge inventory left in these spent fuel pools. And to cause a major accident, you simply turn off the cooling or drain the pool. It's a vulnerability of our plants. We did see this happen at Fukushima, where two fuel pools had one, a steam explosion. They both were explosions. And we saw those on TV. Releasing who knows how much radionuclides to the atmosphere. The worst was averted in those explosions, but that was circumstance. It could have been much, much worse than it turned out to be. And that's the concern about currently at nuclear plants. That is the big vulnerability there. But it's not just that. It's, there are earthquakes, there are natural disasters, there are acts of terror. That can release the contents, even a few percent of the cesium, for instance, or the strontium-90 from these massive inventories contained within these reactors. and in the nuclear waste would, you know, lead to a very large area of evacuation and essentially off limits area for thousands of years. So,
as we've seen in Japan,
we're definitely playing with matches here.
Yeah, but I wanted to ask Tom. There is actually on the Hanford site, although that is a military site in which, you know, plutonium for making bombs was produced. In fact, there is a commercial nuclear plant that was built on the site as well, and that's producing electricity.
Yeah, the Columbia Generating Station, and there were supposed to be four of those plants built. Anyone remember Dixie Lee Ray? Anyway, yes. She was Washington's governor and was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission for a while, and she went nuclear crazy and proposed like 9 or 11 plants. And this is the only one that actually got built due to economic and safety circumstances associated with these building these facilities.
Tom, is it still the greatest bankruptcy in American history? I think it was the largest bond default.
I don't know. I think so. Many people lost their retirements and whatnot, the intentions, because of the bond failure that resulted from this. At any rate, this site, this reactor on the Hanford site, is fairly worrisome because of, you can imagine, an event happening either at Hanford that affects operations at the Columbia Generating Station, or vice versa, that could, you know, have a synergistic effect, you know, make the accident 10 times worse because suddenly, you know, these events correlate. So if there's a large radiation release, let's say a tank collapses at Hanford or catches on fire or explodes, there's, you know, the levels of radioactivity inside these facilities is tremendous. You know, you can't be there. The Columbia Generating Station is not that far away, certainly within the zone of evacuation. And so will people have time to secure the reactor, et cetera? We don't know, especially if there is an earthquake and that site is riddled with such faults. You know, there's volcanic action. There's a major river, Columbia River, flowing through the site. Upstream are dams that now have cracks in them. They're old. All of these facilities actually are aging and are less dependable than they once were because steel gets brittle, the concrete falls to pieces. They require a tremendous amount of maintenance and cost just to keep them going. And at some point, they just need to be shut down because they're so unreliable. So the industry actually gets more dangerous as it ages.
Right, and so there's a desire not to... go ahead.
This directive the president to the Department of Energy Secretary Rick Perry that, coal mining should be revved up immediately, as should the productivity of nuclear plants. My mind just automatically assumed that this, if it is to happen, there would be hearings and there would be some discussion as to whether it's feasible. Does the president have the right to order the Department of Energy secretary?
It's a joke.
To do
it's
this
for show. This is a for show order. It's, as far as nuclear plants go, you don't just say, "Oh, let's have new nuclear plants." You know, the lead time to build these things is 10 to 20 years. Each one cost $10 billion or more. We've only got, there were only two under construction in the last 25 years. The industry is flatlined. It's dead. Wall Street has turned its back on this industry. There are cheaper forms and safer forms of producing energy, and more lucrative, by the way. Because of the nuclear waste disposal price tag, no one really knows how much nuclear power costs. So if you just look at the one slice of it, of an operating reactor's history, you know, discounting the cost of the reactor and the county disposal and discounting all the other things where the government subsidizes, then it looks pretty cheap. But when you actually consider the entire what's called fuel cycle, it's a horrendous cost. And even with all those government subsidies, Wall Street has lost its shirt again and again by banking on these giant projects that then end in failure. So Trump, you know, saying, oh, we're going to have nuclear now. Congress has to, you know, pay for more subsidies. Wall Street has to step up. And I just don't think it's going to work. I think there are many, many reasons why nuclear is flatlined and it won't come back, at least with light water reactors. Now, there are some new proposals out there for, you know, new reactors. So we'll see where those go. You know, Terra Power and, you know, thorium reactors and small modular reactors. So they're, but all of those are, you know, in the early kind of research stages, not ready for prime time, probably not for another 10 to 20 years for any of them. So anyway, I just think it's, when I heard that on the radio, I just kind of laughed. It's like Trump and his wall. Is it really happening? No. Will it to some degree or another? Yeah, probably. But in the end, he'll be long gone before anyone spends any money on this.
Strange juxtaposition that the president would on one hand want to bring back more coal while at the same time saying he wants more nuclear. The two dirtiest ways of producing power. And strangely enough, one representing the 19th century and one the 20th century, but we're here in the 21st century. It's time for something new, it seems. Yeah. And I was very heartened by the last trip I took across country, had the opportunity to see all the windmills that are going up in the western part of the United States, especially out of the desert in areas far from where anybody lives, mile after mile of wind-powered turbines. And I'm crossing my fingers that that will actually come to fruition, that we'll have wind and solar might actually really be happening. You know, that this has a real opportunity to do that. People seem to be jumping into it. Yeah, make money actually with that.
It's amazing. In fact, there's a glut of electrical energy in Washington State because of dams, because of solar and wind. And, they've also got the Columbia Generating Station. Guess what? Almost none of that energy is actually used in the state of Washington. They just sell it, you know, to California, for instance. So we're creating all this waste, and we get so much energy on the grid, especially in the summertime, that, the system out here is all Bonneville Power Administration. They order the windmills shut down to let the nuclear plant keep going. It's like, what? What are your priorities here? But that's where Trump could have an impact, is on subsidies, on financial support, on et cetera. But he's got to run roughshod over a lot of licensing processes and whatnot. And nothing happens fast. You know, these things are just so big and right. So expensive. You got to find people to pay for it.
Right. And then looking back at Hanford and dealing with the waste there, because, right now, we this is the main thing, but, you know, we're talking about, but I know that, and I've been reading the Nuclear Posture Review, which was released just a few months ago by the government, which is basically this plan by the agency that's in charge of nuclear weapons, the NNSA, to renovate all the nuclear weapons facilities in the whole country and to go back to producing the triggers, they call them the plutonium pits at the center of every atom bomb, to start producing them again. Although there are thousands of them on storage, I'm told, in Texas, they still want to go back to producing them, and they're trying to pick a place to produce them. And now they're talking about either Los Alamos or Savannah River in South Carolina. Is Hanford totally a cleanup, or are there any rumblings about reopening Hanford to start doing something in regards to this new $1.5 trillion plan to renovate the nuclear arsenal?
Yeah, there's no talk of reopening Hanford at all. They kind of made a run at that back in the 90s and wanted to keep this reactor that was on life support called the Fast Flux Test Facility up and going so they could make tritium for hydrogen bombs. Tritium is a radioactive hydrogen. And so it's there was a huge fight in the Northwest over this. Tens of thousands of people turned out to oppose this. It became a political hot potato, and it was organized out of existence, right? So that facility ended up getting shut down, and it was a very firm answer from the Northwest that, you know, we don't want this. And I think they know that. You know, there are other places that are politically more compliant, Colorado, New Mexico, Texas, and South Carolina, being, you know, largely red states and very job dependent on these facilities. Not that Hanford isn't, but Washington State isn't, but it's there's less resistance. And what they're talking about doing is making new weapons out of the existing plutonium stockpile. So there's not really talk of making new plutonium, I don't believe. I think it's all about, in fact, we have a plutonium, you know, surplus. We have so much plutonium, it's dangerous. We don't know what the heck to do with it in storage. And the debate
there's a
is
thousand
whether or not we...
I read that there's 1,000 pounds of plutonium produced by the nuclear energy plants themselves, just in their normal operation, produce plutonium, and the government of Japan has 1,000 pounds of it, enough if they wanted to make hundreds of bombs, and they want to get rid of it. They're trying to find somebody. Nobody will take it, which it's almost pathetic, but it's sort of. That we would be 75 years from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 80 years since then, and the country that was bombed is trying to get rid of enough, you know, more bomb-making fuel than it could ever anybody would ever want in their territory of their country. They just can't find a place to get rid of it.
Right.
Might they send it to Hanford?
Well, this brings me to a question that I'd like you both to tackle, and that is the popular perception that nuclear plants, even if something goes wrong, you know, we're living in the city. It's not going to affect us. These plants are in remote areas. And even if something goes wrong, people would still be in some way or the other protected just by reason of their distance from a nuclear plant. Could you address the idea that that ain't so?
Well, plenty of plants are within striking distance of populations, large population centers. In New York, even, and in the Northeast, it's a crowded little place up there. And these plants, you know, they have 50-mile evacuation zones around all of them. So it's, you know, that's what they figure they need if the worst were to happen at a nuclear plant. Now, depending on wind direction, weather conditions, et cetera, on the day that it happens and the severity of the release, it could be bigger than that. The Hanford site has had releases, some of them deliberate, that were found, you know, thousands of miles away. The potential, look at Chernobyl, right? It contaminated Europe. There's just no question that encircled the globe, that, you know, cloud of contamination. That was one reactor accident. And it's still a ongoing concern. Like, they recently put a new sarcophagus around it, a big, you know, cement roof and barrier, because they're that worried about it reigniting as an accident. Doesn't do anything to protect the groundwater, by the way. Fukushima, you know, that accident happened in 2011 because of an earthquake and a tsunami and a poor design of a plant. Well, here we are. They still don't have a good idea of where the reactors are situated that melted down. Three reactors melted down, huge evacuation zone, highly contaminated in that area. Contamination definitely hit, you know, there's articles about, you know, cesium 137 in Tokyo. There's a lot of concern about where that accident, the long-term effects of what that accident will bring about. And the industry response seems to be these days, including at Hanford, well, it's not so bad. Let's just raise the radiation limits that are okay to be exposed to. And Japan certainly did that. They took their limits of exposure after the Fukushima accident and relaxed them tremendously and said, oh, well, people can be exposed to higher levels now. And it was like, what? Why? Well, because that was just practical. That's what they could do. It'd be too expensive otherwise. You know, Hanford is had a set of plutonium releases in 2017 that contaminated 42 workers internally, and probably a lot more, but they only tested a limited number of workers, and they did limited testing on those workers, and yet still found 42 of them with contamination. And the response to it wasn't, we should never have contaminated these people, or there was carelessness and it's tragic. It was like, oh, well, wasn't that much plutonium. It's acceptable levels of plutonium. Really? Acceptable levels of plutonium? Would you say that about your grandchildren or your children? Oh, yeah, you inhaled some plutonium, honey. That's an acceptable level. No, this stuff causes cancer, you know, and all kinds of illnesses. There's a lot of controversy about it. And, you know, there are probably circumstances where people inhale plutonium and they're fine. And there's plenty of other circumstances where not. But we don't have anything in science approaching an acceptable threshold. But that's how the nuclear industry is starting to cast it, is there's a threshold below which that exposure doesn't hurt you. And that's their answer. They've kind of like, yeah, there's going to be accidents. We're going to lose plants, you know, every 15 to 20 years. We're going to have a huge area of that's an evacuation zone. But it's no big deal. So just get ready, right? As long as they hold sway, as long as you have a Trump in office, and it's not just Trump, right? There were plenty of Democrats that have been very pro-nuclear. It's a very rich industry, et cetera, et cetera. So there are definitely a lobby for it. Until there is an organizing movement that really just kind of shuts it down, and a good replacement, and that's starting to happen. With renewable energy, we just don't need these plants anymore. And nuclear turns out to be too expensive and too risky.
Right.
Now, you put out a news release today, Tom. What are you asking for?
Well, ironically, we're asking for the department to do what it's legally required to do and what the deal with the community has been out here, the Northwest community, with the Department of Energy, for decades. And that deal is this. You've got these underground nuclear waste tanks that are falling to pieces, that are a threat, that have leaked and should not be in service. If they could be taken out of service today, right, and emptied and dealt with, there'd be a huge sigh of relief in the entire Northwest. That hasn't happened, despite $20 billion of taxpayer money being used just for the purpose of tank waste remediation. The plan is remove this waste, treat it in a vitrification facility, that is, turn this waste into glass, and bury that in a deep geological repository. Now, they'd have to pre-treat the waste and remove, high-activity portion and low-activity portion, and there'd be some waste after it's treated that would stay at the Hanford site because the volumes are so huge. And that's okay as long as there is, a low enough concentration of radionuclides and chemicals, et cetera, in the waste that's been treated that's on site. But that's not what they're planning to do. At this point, last Monday, June 4th, the federal government said, oh, we've got a new proposal. We're just going to remove waste from some of these tanks, and we're going to leave some behind, this residue, and we're just going to dump concrete on top of that and call it good. So I looked at their press. I'm ready for this, right? I've been studying this for the last almost year. We've been collecting documents and talking to people. The residual waste they're talking about is a tremendous quantity of radioactivity. One tank out there, C-102, has enough waste left over in it to cover a football field 1 foot thick. That is a lot of high-level nuclear waste to simply walk away from. That's one tank out of 16 tanks. There are pounds of plutonium in this stuff. That's really long-lived waste. What they plan to do is put cement in the tanks on top of this waste and say, we're done. We've closed the tanks. We've turned the page. The chapter's done. This tank farm is cleaned up, using only their words. That's it. They're just going to say it's not high-level waste anymore. It's low-level waste. Well, that's not going to work, science doesn't care. Nature doesn't care what you call it. The effect is going to be the same. So that's what our press release is about, is, we are ready to challenge this. We are ready to take them to court if necessary. There is a public comment period coming up, going through September 7th. We're urging everyone that cares about this kind of thing to, file public comments. We're meeting with our members of Congress, our state legislators, the governor, the attorney general, Oregon, Native tribes. We're organizing and to stop this plan from going into effect, which would happen in the next year once they get through all their little processes, and if the state allows them or if a federal court doesn't stop them. So that's our new crisis, is we're going to have to be throwing everything we've got into maintaining the status quo. We wish that we were focused on improving the cleanup at the site, focusing on some hotspot areas that need remediation and those kind of things. But this is, this is the number one crisis for us. It's one of our most important challenges out there. It's the Trump administration trying to shortcut this cleanup in order to save money and to get it done, even though it won't be protective. Essentially, the proposal is this: let's turn Hanford into a high-level nuclear waste repository, and it's not suitable for that. There's a major river goes through that site. It's riddled with earthquake faults. There's volcanoes. There's glacial flooding that happens there. There are dams upstream that are subject to failing and just drowning that site. So this is not a place that we should be thinking about long-term storage of nuclear waste.
Tom, whatever happened to the $13 billion vitrification plant? Up till this point, it's always been about this plant, and all the focus was we're going to get this vitrification plant going, turn all this waste into glass. And then I read somewhere that they turned 3 gallons out of the 57 million in the 177 tanks we've been talking about historically. Have they just given up on it? Is that why they're doing 3 gallons? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, the 3 gallons was a research project, and they're allowed to do that under the state permit, for research and development purposes. And, they treated that waste at something, a place called Permafix. And now they're proposing to, and mixed it with concrete. And now they're proposing to do the same thing with 8,000 gallons of waste. But Congress stepped in and said, well, we're not paying for that. And the state of Washington, I'm pretty sure, would not permit it, right? Because the state of Washington does have permit authority over this waste to some degree. So they've got a fight on their hands as far as that goes. The vitrification plant is a very troubled facility that's been subject to a lot of mismanagement and corruption, as well as technical challenges. This plant goes way back. It goes back to the 1980s, and it was designed by the British Nuclear Fuels in 1990, whatever, 5 or 6. They never broke ground, but they did come up with this design that turned out to be too small, and was insufficient, and also had some elements to it that were just poor design elements, right? They didn't know what they were doing, right? And they got fired, and a company called Bechtel came in and took over that contract, stuck with the old design. Bechtel sent in, folks that, I think people have said they're second and third string technical people, and they blew out their requirements for nuclear safety and design as if, this were a chemical plant that had nuclear materials as opposed to a nuclear plant that had chemicals. So they just didn't they didn't have quality control and quality assurance, meaning, the equipment that they put in there, the workmanship, all that didn't meet nuclear laws requiring nuclear quality, and they got caught. So this is what all the whistleblowers that we helped represent came forward with. And, it included, their chief engineer and the head of nuclear safety and the head of research and technology, very, very senior technical people. Their chief scientist became a whistleblower, et cetera. And they, they kind of unloaded on this plant, got a lot of attention. Eventually, they were validated. Their concerns were validated. And in 2012, the plant was put on suspension. And they went back to, a design phase again. So they are just now starting to recover from that. They think they have the plant under control from a design perspective. They're planning to vitrify a portion of the waste called low-level waste in 2022 or 2023. And whether they can make those deadlines or be successful remains to be seen.
I see.
Why does it come across that people in Congress or even state legislatures aren't really excited about this problem so as to keep it constantly at front and center of their legislative action? Why is there such a sense that, we'll get to it?
Well, we had a guest legislator come and talk at one of our conferences a few years back. And, he said, look, if I get behind, a bridge or an office building or, some kind of big project that's going to help some community, I'm going to be a hero in that community. I brought money. I brought jobs. It's a good thing. It's a positive thing. And I'm proud to have my name associated with that bridge or that school that's being built or whatever it is. Hanford, you guys got a problem. Because who wants to have, your name on a nuclear waste facility that could blow up, right? You don't want your name on a sewer plant. You don't want it on a nuclear waste plant. And he had a point, which is it's a hard thing to champion, especially given the long time frames that it takes, the huge amounts of money, of taxpayer money that it takes, and the corruption that happens at the Hanford site. They've been hit over and over and over again with False Claims Act suits that they've either lost or pleaded guilty to or settled out of court for hundreds of millions of dollars that these contractors have stolen from the taxpayer. And they got caught doing it, and they got prosecuted for it or taken into civil court for it. And their response was to, give up and just pay some money and to make the suits go away or to plead guilty. And there's not enough oversight at Hanford. The Department of Energy, the federal government is too close to the contractors. The system is just set up to fail. And it's big. It's $2.2 billion a year flowing into the Hanford so-called cleanup. And there's some good stuff happening at the Hanford cleanup. But when it comes to the nuclear waste tanks, not so good.
I see. So what is your last few minutes here? Tom Carpenter Hanford Challenge. What is the prognosis, at least for the next couple of years under this administration? What is the best we can hope for, and what do you see happening?
Well, I fear that the best we can hope for is to survive and have holding actions to prevent bad ideas from being executed. I'm not so sure that in this administration we're going to be seeing wonderful news when it comes to nuclear matters, radioactive waste disposition, safety issues. The first year, of the Trump administration at Hanford has been unqualified, disaster. It's just been, they had a lot of problems caught up to them. And it could get much, much worse, and I fear it will as budgets, get cut, and as the emphasis becomes saving money and hurrying up, which is what gets us into problems over and over again. It's like, no, it's not about. No, I'll just say this: it's like we spent as Americans $9 trillion. To make nuclear weapons. That's what our arsenal cost to become a nuclear power. We're looking at the cleanup of the Hanford site costing $150 billion, maybe. Maybe less, but right now that's what it looks like the price tag is going to be. It's not that great compared to what we spent to create, this arsenal. And no one thinks that way, et cetera, but I just want to put that perspective out there. So I think that we will be looking for opportunities with our own delegation and with other members of Congress that care about this to do some good stuff. One thing I'd love to see happen is, nuclear waste is reserved for regulation only to the Department of Energy as far as the pure radioactivity of it. And that should be subject to RCRA, which is the hazardous waste law, so that states can regulate this waste as well as the federal government to protect their own citizens. So that is a change we're looking to Congress to make. We'd love to see more external oversight over Hanford. Eventually, we'd love to see a new agency created whose only mission is to clean up that site. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just going to ask. It just seems that from what you're describing, the whole idea of the security aspect of this has allowed the federal government to do things that a state environmental protection organization might not allow to happen within the borders of their state. They always could claim, well, it's wartime where we have an enemy who's building nuclear weapons, et cetera. Those days are over, yet we still seem to be under those kind of national security constraints that allow for waste to be dumped and concrete to be put. These quick shortcut solutions just meant to keep the problem under the radar while they move on to build more weapons. I mean, are we ever going to be able to get beyond that kind of way of thinking?
Oh, yeah, we will. It'll just take time. But, it's why we're here as an organization. There are other organizations like Columbia River Keeper, keeping an eye on this situation, working hard, to communicate with our members of Congress, with our state legislators. Washington State just did a great thing to better protect workers at the Hanford site and give them compensation for illnesses that happen at the Hanford site by removing this requirement that workers show causation. If you worked at the Hanford site and you have one of a list of diseases like cancer, then it's presumed that it came from working at the Hanford site unless you had that cancer before you started working there, and other, what are called presumptions, rebuttable presumptions. But it makes it a lot easier for workers now to get compensation, and they are on the front lines of, the health effects and the problems going on as a result of making all of this radioactive stuff over the years. And we've got decades in front of us before this problem is taken care of. So I kind of see it as we're in a race against time. You've got these highly dangerous facilities, such as the Tank Farms, and there's others out there with very large inventories of plutonium and radioactive materials, a release of which to the air, to the water, would be disastrous. So we need
to... Well, we have to leave it there, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
Sorry, there.
That's okay. No, it's...
sorry,
what
Paul.
I to say, so.
But we're running out of time.
Fascinating story. No, thank you very much, Tom, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much
for having
me on.
Yeah, thank you. Oh, your website, yes.
And thank you to Paul for helping us understand this very complex issue, as you have for so many series and sessions, and hopefully people will understand where this whole discussion is going. Thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next, What in the Cell is Going On? That's the name of the program. I didn't invent it. But we'll see. Thank you.